intentionally inclusive congregation, and we welcome everyone to our church. We wish to extend special hospitality to those of you who are guests with us this morning. If you'd like to learn more about our church, please visit the welcome table just outside in the foyer. Would you please join with me in affirming our mission statement, which is printed in your order of service and on the very wall of our church. We gather in community to nourish souls, transform lives, and do justice.
Good morning. My name is Elizabeth Gray, and my partner, Eugene, and I have been members of this church for almost 20 years. And yes, that's why the glasses. As you may be aware, our congregation is on a five-week UU journey with food. Each Sunday during this journey with food, we focus on a different aspect of food choice. If you don't already have a packet of these note cards that were handed out early in the month, there are more available at the entrance to the sanctuary. Do keep these cards at your dinner table and discuss the weekly topics with families and friends. And today, we ask you to reflect on local food. Our food comes from many different places and often must travel hundreds and thousands of miles to get to our grocery stores. As food travels from other parts of our country and world, a vast amount of energy is consumed. People often refer to this travel in food miles. Food miles measure the distance that food travels from field to plate. In the United States, food typically travels, imagine this, between 1,500 and 2,500 miles from farm to plate. Because our food often travels such far distance to reach our local stores, fossil fuels are burned in transport, which adds substantially to the carbon dioxide emissions that contribute to global climate change. This week, learn about where your food comes from and buy at least one local or Texas-grown food. Look for the green Go Texan sticker that you'll see in stores. One way to reduce food miles is by purchasing food from a local farm. Our local farmers work hard every day to grow healthy and nutritious foods, and they are important stewards of our land. Unlike industrial agricultural operations, small family farmers live on or near their farms and strive to preserve the surrounding environment for future generations. Since these farmers have a vested interest in their communities, they are more likely to use sustainable farming techniques to protect natural resources and our human health. At a large supermarket, only 18 cents of every dollar goes to the grower. 82 cents goes to shippers, distributors, and others. By purchasing food from your local farmer, you ensure that they receive the greatest return on their product and will help them to continue farming.
Good morning. I appreciate this opportunity to preach here. Ed Brock issued an invitation, for which I'm grateful, and Nell Newton became the service leader, and I appreciate Brett and Brent and all the people who made this possible, Karina and Elizabeth, and all of you, for whom it would be pointless. I attended your service on March 20th when Ed Brock and Karina Whitaker Lewis launched her focus on food. And so when I was thinking about my sabbatical immersion experience in India, I could have spoken about the music and the dance or the temples and the culture, but I decided to focus on food. And then it occurred to me that I didn't just mean food to feed our bodies, but food to fill our spirits, that the spirit of wholeness is what I'm after. Because it seems to me that everyone is hungry for something at one time or another, and sometimes we're not even sure what that is. A lot of us have plenty to eat, but something is missing in our lives. And people will tell me, I'm spiritual but not religious. Or they'll tell me they need something to feed their spirits. It might be an ill-defined feeling like emptiness. Something is missing. Life has no meaning. And it's easy to fill our lives with things like food or work or love, entertainment, reading, shopping, anything that fills our day, but maybe not fill our spirits. There are lots of positive and negative ways to fill a spiritual hunger. But I do want to take you on a quick trip to India without the 25-hour travel time, which is how long it took us to get from Austin to Chennai. And Chennai is a port city on the southeast side of India on the Bay of Bengal. About 12 years ago, the Reverend Abhi Janamanchi told his congregation in Clearwater, Florida, that he would someday take a group of Unitarian Universalists to his home country. The members did not forget, and they kept reminding him of this promise until finally he did it this year. He would lead a group to the sacred places of India, in the south primarily, and then in the northeast, way beyond Bangladesh. I guess northeast is that way to you. And to Unitarian schools and churches and to Delhi and Agra. It was all over a three-week period. I was very intrigued, in part because a colleague of mine had said that everyone should travel to India at least once in a lifetime. And it just happened to fall during my sabbatical period. Now, some of you may have had the pleasure of hearing Abhi preach at General Assembly a couple of years ago with all his Hindu mythology sprinkled through the sermon. It was the first time I'd met him and his wife, Lalita. I liked him, and I thought it would be worth the risk of traveling with an unknown group of strangers, because, face it, even Unitarian Universalists can be very strange indeed. The only itinerary he gave us was a list of the cities we would visit and the hotels where we would spend the night. Abhi would brief us in the morning on the places we would go that day. I knew that India would be a land of contrasts, such as wealth and poverty, beauty and squalor, temples and slums. I knew I would be entering another culture, and that it would be wise for me to let go of expectations and to let go of quick judgments. Abhi's objective was to provide us with an in-depth experience of life in India, especially in the smaller towns. He said, "We share a common humanity. We don't have to look alike or live alike to feel a human connection." He wrote a script for a play, and we were the players involved in the ongoing drama that is India. From day one, after just a very few hours of sleep, we started visiting multiple temples and palaces and museums and homes. We were introduced to a pantheon of deities. They were Hindu or Buddhist, Christian, Jain, Sikh, Muslim, and there were plenty of secular heroes and philosophers. I am now extraordinarily fond of Shiva, Saraswati, Ganesha, and Kali. The spirit in me was awakened by what I experienced. Although I really don't know about the level of spirituality in India, it appeared to be everywhere, steeped in a different mythology, and many religions thriving in various parts of the country or side by side. More than once, tears came to my eyes among the devotees at the temples. And there was a special blessing by a priest who put a garland from the dancing Shiva around my neck. And I felt as though I'd been ordained again as a Hindu. We fed our bodies too, of course, on delicious Indian food, idli with chutney or sambar, dal with vegetables, shahi paneer, lots of kinds of paneer, and plenty of steamed rice, and naan, and parathi, and roti. The list goes on. We would look at the menu and say, oh, we haven't tried that. Let's do that one. We were aware that Hindus do not eat beef, but they do eat other meats. And Muslims and Christians eat beef. There was a wider range of foods we could choose. One guy joked that with his luck, he would come back in his next lifetime as a cow in a Muslim neighborhood. Now, two particular destinations in India were related to food. One was an organic farm right on the Godavari River in the city of Rajahmundry. Abhi's cousin Krishna owns and operates land that sits on a bluff 30 feet above a river. The Godavari River flows all the way from Mumbai in western India through the southern area and on to sea, and so it collects water from many miles of land. Now, from that farm high above the river, we could see islands where fishermen lived and worked. And we knew that during the rainy season, those islands would be submerged. In fact, last August, the river grew 50 feet, and the farm was flooded by some 20 feet of water. So Krishna and everyone had to move the cattle, the water buffalo, turkeys, chickens, guinea fowl, dogs, and people to higher ground. Their crops suffered quite a bit of damage. The sugar cane, mangoes, bananas, cashews, coconuts, and rice. Krishna showed us how sugar cane is laid out flat on the ground and new shoots come up from those canes in an 11-month growing season. And in between those rows, they plant rice. They harvest it twice a year because it has a 4-month growing season. One of the workers for our entertainment, as well as a project, climbed a palm tree in his bare feet with a machete in one hand and a rubber belt for safety. And he went up there to cut down bunches of coconuts for our enjoyment. Now, these were water coconuts, not milk. And he brought them down. He expertly chopped off each top and put a straw into the coconut. And each of us had a delightfully refreshing drink. It's clear in color and does not have a strong flavor, but it was very delicious. And when we drank the water, we ate some of the coconut meat and sweets made with cashews and dates and mangoes. As you know, you have visited community gardens in this area, like just in the neighborhood, or the Capital Area Food Bank, or attended some other event about food. And so you can appreciate the challenges for Krishna of farming and distributing nutritious organic foods. There is a spiritual connection to the food and to the land. Another amazing place we went was about an hour's drive outside of Delhi. It was a slum, or a basti, one of about 70 on the outskirts of the city. You're not going to find this described in The Lonely Planet. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about trash. We mostly throw it away and forget about it. In In Delhi, the streets are pretty clean, as big cities go, but not all of the trash is carried away in big trucks. Some of it is loaded into big burlap bags on bicycle carts. It's not always food they're after, although they wouldn't turn down a good piece of fruit. They're looking for recyclables like plastic, cardboard, clothing, fabric, and metal that they can sell for a little bit of money. They're just trying to eke a living on the margins of society. We met the activist Shashi Dusan Pandit, who grew up in a poor area of India, and he could see the exploitation of poor people. We found out later that his name Pandit means scholar, and indeed he did come from an educated family and was able to go to college. But while he was growing up, he would see things like loans of 100 rupees would be charged 10 rupees per day of interest. So in a week, you owe 170 rupees. He saw that temples would acquire land that was needed by peasants, and the peasants would have no place to farm. After college, he became an activist at a very basic grassroots level. Shashi rode on the bus with us to Pua for an hour. We were greeted by a half dozen young men who protected us from any harassment or problem, because normally white people don't go into these areas. It had rained the night before our visit, so the ground was muddy and slippery, and some of the guys would offer us a hand to help us through the mud. At the site, someone had written in chalk, welcome, in English and in Hindi. And they laid out some tarps in a clearing and found a dozen or so matching chairs in a circle awaiting our arrival. They were eager to tell us their story. We looked around for a while first and noticed finally that there were organizational systems in place. There were the plastic piles and the cardboard and the metal, various things. There were certainly dogs wandering around and cows eating any food scraps that were available. And then we saw bicycle carts that would bring in new loads of stuff for people to sort and pick through. Not only do they pick up trash, they also live there in the huts around the edge of this dump. They were made of tarps and metal. There would be a row of shoes on top of the hut because they didn't wear their shoes inside. There were lots and lots of flies. And at first, while I was sitting there, I was brushing them away. But after a while, I kind of got used to them. At any rate, I was absorbed in listening to our host because Shashi spoke to us with passion. We did not understand his language of Hindi, but we did hear the word privatization because the private corporations are taking away the livelihood of the poor. He is adamant that they will not give up until their needs are addressed. It's kind of like community organizing in the U.S. when they're learning to stand up for their rights, how to use democracy effectively, how to use unions, how to unionize, because that's what they're trying to do. But one difficulty in forming a union is that you have to list your employer. And it's very hard to list everyone as your employer. The Indian government has special economic zones that are also known as exploitation zones, in which the state acquires land cheaply, usually from peasant farmers who are on hard times, and resell it cheaply to industry. He told us about a nearby temple that was paid for mostly with non-Indian money, and it displaced 20,000 people. And right next to the site is a 5-star hotel under construction. And so the people who live there know that they're going to have to move again, because 5-star hotels and tourists and business travelers do not mix well with slums. We met one of the activists by the name of Manoj. He's one of the waste pickers as well. But his wife, who has a high school education, decided that she should start a school. Classes are normally held outside for about 70 children. But since it rained the night before our visit, they used a small classroom with a leaky roof, and only about 30 children could fit inside there. There was a wide age range from about 12 years old to toddlers that were sitting on their siblings' laps. Viva teaches with very few educational materials, but she teaches reading, writing, and arithmetic, teaches in Hindi and English, and about the days and weeks and seasons, the things that kids need to know. She would call on students who would stand up and proudly recite their lessons. Viva would love to offer a midday meal, partly for nutrition for these children, but also as an incentive for them to come to school and for their parents to send them. Her dream someday is to have basic immunizations and checkups in the area. Shashi is involved in making ID cards for the workers. They are in red and green, red for labor and green for the environment. There's a recycling symbol on the back of the card and a name, a photo ID, that helps them establish their citizenship documentation, because they don't all have birth certificates. They were not all born in hospitals. A lot of them are from very poor areas in Bihar and West Bengal and even Bangladesh. Now, their work actually saves the Indian government millions of rupees every year, but they keep getting pushed further outside. Some of us wondered about the birth rate, but we were reminded to consider the death rate as well. Infant mortality is high, and life expectancy is low in the absence of health care or adequate nutrition. I felt like it was a privilege to meet these hardworking people and to think for a while about our part in this whole system of exploitation and marginalization and tourism. Our small group donated some cash to assist with slates and chalk and other educational materials for the kids. But we knew it was only a Band-Aid in a system of checks and imbalances. The activism described here has a Unitarian Universalist connection, and that's one of the reasons we were able to go. In fact, Peter Morales, our UUA president, has been there. The Holding India Fund was established by a real estate mogul who left millions of dollars in trust to the UUA. And he wanted a tax shelter, actually. He was not a Unitarian Universalist. He'd never been to India, although he had heard about the issues. But after he died, he left all this money, and there was a long period of negotiation about how to handle this money. And finally, $25 million was put into an endowment, and the interest of it is used for grassroots activism, like I described. The leaders, Kathy Streeter is one of the leaders, they look for people like Shashi who are doing work and figure out a plan to help them with funding and training and maybe finding partners who can help them achieve their goals. They put a 2 or 3 year limit on their work with the people so that they don't become dependent on the Holding India Fund. The caste system was removed from the Indian Constitution, and it is no longer official policy, But as you know, we don't have racism in this country anymore because it's not legal, right? A lot of these people came from very poor areas of India, from small villages where people took care of each other. And they came to the big city and found their own culture shock because they were anonymous. People didn't care for one another. They didn't even know one another like they had in the villages. But the waste pickers do have strength in numbers, and they have fought successfully from time to time against for-profit corporations. They are working for survival, not much for profit. And sometimes the authorities actually side with the people who clean up after everyone else, including us. Now, statistics on world hunger are estimates based on income per capita versus the cost of food in various parts of the world. It is not an exact science. In medical terms, it would be termed malnutrition. The first kind of malnutrition has to do with protein and energy. It would be an inadequate protein intake and not enough calories from all the basic food groups. Another kind of malnutrition is micronutrient deficiency. They don't even consider that when they figure out statistics about world hunger. And then a third and growing concern is the overabundance of poor food choices that can lead to obesity as well as malnutrition. But why should anyone be hungry or malnourished? According to the United Nations FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the number of hungry people has increased since 1995, although the number is down from 2010. The increase has been due to three factors. One, neglect of agriculture relevant to very poor people by governments and international agencies. Two, the current worldwide economic crisis. And three, the significant increase of food prices in the last several years, which has been devastating to those with only a few dollars a day to spend. 925 million people is 13.6% of the estimated world population of 6.8 billion. Nearly all of the undernourished are in developing countries, they said. Now, technically, there is enough food in the world. It's just not all in the right places. World agriculture produces 17% more calories per person than it did 30 years ago, even though there's been a 70% increase in the population. That's a 70% increase. Of course, poverty is the main culprit. When there's no land to grow food and no income to purchase enough food. People in developing countries live on about $1.25 per person per day, about the cost of one song on iTunes. Okay, so why are people poor? A short list includes economic policies, corruption, lack of education, hunger itself, which leads to disease, depression, lack of energy, climate change, and war. Back in that slum in India, I was struck by the generous spirit of the people who lived there. The kids were neat and clean and polite. They offered us tea. They removed their shoes, if they had any, before they went into their huts. The problems of hunger and malnutrition seem worse in India than here from the sheer numbers of people and the policies against agribusiness and its pros and cons. But I was both physically and spiritually nurtured by my trip to India. I discovered once more that I need to tend to my spirit daily. Perhaps as much time as I spend feeding my body. Perhaps you do too. We have various ways to fill our spirits. Time alone, or time volunteering, time with nature, time in prayer, or time with music. Many ways to fill your spirit. You might remember Jackson Brown's song, Running on Empty, from 1977, when he sang, "Looking out at the road rushing under my wheels, I don't know how to tell you all just how crazy this life feels. I look around for the friends that I used to turn to pull me through. Looking into their eyes, I see them running too. Running on empty. Running on, running blind. Running on, running into the sun, but I'm running behind. Running on empty will not get you very far in life. Feed your spirit so that you will have something to give to a hungry world. Amen, Shanti, and Namaste. May we be fed with good food. May we be fed with the spirit of wholeness. And then may we go out fulfilled to feed a hungry world. Amen.
This is a presentation of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, visit our website at www.austinuu.org.